or his alertness or his excitement. What we want is a machine that measures as the player scans an array of possible outcomes in some orderly fashion. The extent to which particular outcomes catches attention or generate excitement in the course of actual bargaining. Given the machine, set up a bargaining game. For simplicity, make it one in which there are certain gains to be shared when agreement is reached on the shares. Give the game enough topical content to provide some room for argument, casuistry, alternative rationales, and so forth. That is, provide more than a bare mathematical range with a conspicuous midpoint. Now, have the two players connected to their machines in such a way that each can see the meter on his own machine, each can see the meter on the other's machine, and each is aware that both are aware that both can see both meters. In other words, they mutually perceive that they both can see each other's reactions to particular outcomes as they come within view of the scanning device. We employ a mechanical scanning device which moves about in the range of possible outcomes, pointing to, lighting up, or focusing on one possible outcome after another. It follows perhaps some regular course, perhaps a random course. Let this machine scan. Let the players watch it scan. Watch their own and each other's meters, and watch each other's faces if they wish to. Finally, we go through with the game, and there may be several variants. An interesting possibility would be to exclude explicit bargaining and simply let the scanning proceed back and forth or round and round among the array of alternative outcomes. We watch to see whether the recorded reactions of the two players tend eventually to converge on a single outcome in the sense that their involuntary, physically identifiable reactions are at some kind of maximum for the same particular outcome among all those to which the scanning device elicits their reactions. For control purposes, we might once have subjected each player to a scanning session in which the other player was absent, to get some notion of each player's reactions independently of any interaction between the players. If convergence does occur, we have certainly identified a significant phenomenon, whether or not we can allege that this is the psychic bargaining process. We shall have demonstrated, A, that players do react to the content of the bargaining situation, and B, that their reactions are subject to a mutual interaction that results from the fact that each can see the other's reaction, and each knows that his own visible reaction is yielding information about his own expectations. The writer conjectures that, like Lot's wife, players will often be unable to keep their attention from being drawn to particular outcomes, even unfavorable outcomes, and that a conscious effort to ignore a focal point may often enhance the focal power. Another variant would be to let the players bargain explicitly during the scanning and metering. With the scanning device inexorably eliciting their physical reactions in the course of the discussion in a manner visible to both of them, we could even, in this latter case, let a player adduce the evidence of the visible reaction meters if he wished to as a bargaining tactic, pointing out to his partner, for example, that the latter obviously cannot expect to hold out for, say, the $60 he is verbally demanding when it is clear from his blood pressure that his mind is settled on $40. This experiment would rest on three hypotheses. First, that an individual player would have physically identifiable reactions upon contemplating different alternatives among the range of possible game outcomes, and that these reactions would be conspicuously different among the different alternatives. Second, that these reactions, when the player knows that they are naked to his partner's eye, would behave in a manner suggestive of bargaining. That is, that the reactions of the two players, when visible to both of them, would interact in a kind of bargaining process. Third, that this measured phenomenon, which we liken to a bargaining process, is part of, or is involved in, or is related to, the bargaining process as defined in the ordinary way. An experiment of the sort described might prove especially interesting for the case of more than two persons. The experiment has not been carried out and is not adduced as evidence. It has been described here in order to give an operational representation of the theoretical system that the author has in mind in referring to the convergence of expectations, and to suggest that the convergence that ultimately occurs in a bargaining process may depend on the dynamics of the process itself, and not solely on the a priori data of the game. Some dynamic characteristics of focal point solutions. The dependence of a focal point solution on some characteristic that distinguishes it qualitatively from the surrounding alternatives has important dynamic considerations. For example, it often makes small concessions less likely than large ones. It often means that the focal point is more persuasive as an exact expected outcome than as an approximation. If a bargainer has persistently been unsuccessfully demanding 50%, compromise at 47% is unlikely. The small concession may be a sign of collapse. Qualitative principles are hard to compromise, and focal points generally depend on qualitative principles. One cannot expect to satisfy an aggressor by letting him have a few square miles on this side of a boundary. He knows that we both know that we both expect our side to retreat until we find some persuasive new boundary that can be rationalized. In fact, a focal point for agreement often owes its focal character to the fact that small concessions would be impossible, that small encroachments would lead to more and larger ones. One draws a line at some conspicuous boundary or rests his case on some conspicuous principle that is supported mainly by the rhetorical question, if not here, where? The more it is clear that concession is collapse, the more convincing the focal point is. The same point is illustrated in the game that we play against ourselves when we try to give up cigarettes or liquor. Just one little drink is a notoriously unstable compromise offer, and more people give up cigarettes altogether than manage to reach a stable compromise at a small daily quota. Once the virgin principle is gone, there is no confidence in any resting point, and expectations converge on complete collapse. The very recognition of this keeps attention focused on the point of complete abstinence. Sometimes the focal point itself is inherently unstable. In that case, it serves not as an outcome, but as a sign of where to look for the outcome. This is often true of a test vote in a legislative body or a test issue that arises in the relations between the players in some continuing game. Often, it is a challenge or a dare or an act of defiance that, by its nature, must either elicit a submissive response from the other party or be submissively withdrawn. It is a small piece of the game that comes to symbolize the game itself, setting a pattern of expectations that extends beyond the substance of the point involved. Sometimes it is so intended and constitutes a deliberate tactic. In other cases, the act or the issue develops an unintended symbolic significance, making compromise impossible. Diplomatic recognition of the communist regime in China, loyalty oaths at universities, a strike settlement in a key industry, surrender of the floor to an interrupter at a cocktail party, or the vote on some particular motion at a political convention may all have this kind of significance. Sometimes, it is true, the outcome on this particular issue simply yields evidence of how other issues would be decided, as when a test vote indicates exactly how large the opposition to a measure is. But often the particular issue is not representative of the rest of the game. It just acquires tacit recognition as a clue to all that will follow, so that each side is the prisoner or beneficiary of the mutual expectations that are created. Often this phenomenon can be identified as an actual signal in a coordination game. The members of an unorganized coalition can often recognize the potentialities of concerted action without being sure that agreement exists to act in concert. One wants to know how everyone else is going to act, and whether everyone else will do what he knows he ought to. A test vote in a legislature or some particular simultaneous action among the group, like a mass protest, is often a means of ratifying the existence of the coalition, and of demonstrating that everybody expects everybody else to act in concert. But even in a two-person game, as typified by the dare, the phenomenon of psychological dominance or submissiveness may prove to be psychologically identical with the resolution of a bargaining game. This process, by which particular moves in a game or offers and concessions achieve symbolic importance as indicators of where expectations should converge in the rest of the game, seems to be an area in which experimental psychology can contribute to game theory. The empirical relevance of mathematical foci. We must avoid assuming that everything the analyst can perceive is perceived by the participants in a game, or that whatever exerts power of suggestion on the analyst does so on the participant in a game. In particular, game characteristics that are relevant to sophisticated mathematical solutions, except when the same solution can also be reached by an alternative, less sophisticated route, might not have this power of focusing expectations and influencing the outcome. They might have it only if the players perceived each other to be mathematicians. This may be the empirical interpretation of such solutions as those of Braithwaite, Nash, Harsanyi, and others. It is that the mathematical properties of a game, like the aesthetic properties, the historical properties, the legal and moral properties, the cultural properties, and all the other suggestive and connotative details, can serve to focus the expectations of certain participants on certain solutions. If two players are themselves mathematical game theorists, they may mutually perceive and be powerfully affected by potential solutions that have compelling mathematical properties. Each may transcend, and know that the other will transcend, various adventitious details that, to non-mathematician game players, might be more relevant to the focusing of expectations than some of the quantitative properties of the game. In many cases, these mathematical properties would be a uniqueness or symmetry that would have non-mathematical definitions and non-mathematical appeal too, or would happen to coincide with qualitatively distinguishable points that could be rationalized in an equally compelling non-mathematical way. Thus, mathematical solutions are one species of a genus of influences that have the power to focus expectations. But they work through the same psychic mechanism, this power of suggestion that is able to bring expectations into convergence, as the other species. When husband and wife separated in a department store gaily traipse off to the lost and found by a tacit and jocular mutual appreciation that it is the obvious place to meet, two mathematicians in the same situation, each aware that both are aware that both are mathematicians, might look for a geometrically unique point rather than one that depended on a play on words. The main point here is independent of whether, under the rules of game theory, a rational player must be presumed to know as much mathematics as he ever has need for. We are dealing here with the player's shared appreciations, preoccupations, obsessions, and sensitivities to suggestion, not with the resources that they can draw on when necessary. If the phenomenon of rational agreement is fundamentally psychic, convergence of expectations, there is no presumption that mathematical game theory is essential to the process of reaching agreement. Hence, no basis for presuming that mathematics is a main source of inspiration in the convergence process. One may or may not agree with any particular hypothesis how a bargainer's expectations are formed, either in the bargaining process or before it, and either by the bargaining itself or by other forces. But it does seem clear that the outcome of a bargaining process is to be described most immediately, most straightforwardly, and most empirically in terms of some phenomenon of stabilized convergent expectations. Whether one agrees explicitly to a bargain or agrees tacitly or accepts it by default, he must, if he has his wits about him, expect that he could do no better and recognize that the other party must reciprocate the feeling. Thus, the fact of an outcome, which is simply a coordinated choice, should be analytically characterized by the notion of converging expectations. Communicating subjective information. The role of expressive moves in a mutual accommodation game of this sort is enhanced by the consideration that in mixed motive games, in contrast to zero-sum games that are known to the players to be zero-sum, there is likely to be uncertainty about each other's value system. Moves have an information content in the mixed motive game. Nor can we set up as a general case the bargaining game in which each side has foreknowledge of the other's preferences. To assume that either knows the true payoff matrix of the other is often to make an extraordinary assumption about the institutional arrangements of the game. The reason is that certain elements in a bargaining game are inherently unknowable for some of the participants, except when there are special conditions. How can we know how badly the Russians would dislike an all-out war in which both sides were annihilated? We cannot. And the reason we cannot is not solely that the Russians are necessarily unwilling that we should know. On the contrary, circumstances may arise in which they are desperate that we should know the truth. But how can they make us know it? How can they make us believe that what they tell us is true? How can the prisoner being tortured for secrets that he really does not know persuade his captors that he does not know them? How could the Chinese, if they were really determined to take Formosa at the cost of an all-out war, persuade us that they could not be deterred in any fashion and that any threat on our part would only commit us both to all-out war? In special cases, the information can be conveyed. In an artificial game in which each player's value system is contained on cards or chips, he may simply turn them face up, if the rules permit, or if he and his adversary can jointly cheat against the referee. In a society that believes absolutely in a superior power that will punish falsehood when asked to do so, and that everybody knows everybody else believes in cross my heart and hope to die is a sufficient formula for conveying truth voluntarily. But these are special cases. If we are to have a general case, it must be one in which there is at least some ignorance of each other's value system or each other's strategy options, if only because such facts are inherently unknowable or incommunicable. Von Neumann and Morgenstern illustrated their solution concept for the non-zero-sum game with the example of a seller, A, prepared to sell his house for any price above 10, and two buyers, B and C, prepared to pay up to 15 and 25, respectively. My numbers. The novel part of the solution was that C might pay B a share of his saving if, through B's staying out of the market, C got the house for less than 15. They proposed, and this limitation was inherent in their concept of solution, that the most B might receive from C was 15 minus 10 equals 5. What is interesting about the information requirement of this solution is not that B's reservation price of 15 is something that he might try to misrepresent, but that in the ordinary world he could not convincingly communicate the truth if he wanted to. Not only does the solution concept, by its assumption of full information, rule out the intrusion of speculators, unless they genuinely want the house enough to give them a basis for sharing in the solution, but it assumes that C can discern or B can reveal a subjective truth, one that D and E, speculators who are attracted by the observation that B makes a pure bargaining profit in connection with an object that he never owns before or after, cannot counterfeit. There are undoubtedly special cases in which one can suppose that the other player is like oneself in basic values, and can consequently estimate the other's values by the simple application of symmetry. But in too many exciting cases, one plays an opponent who is a wholly different kind of person. The father of a kidnapped boy will not be very successful in guessing what his own bottom price would be if he had been the kidnapper instead. It may not be easy for a British or French officer introspectively to guess how terrible a penalty would have to be to deter him if he were a Mau Mau or an Algerian terrorist. It is hard for a boy to guess how much he would like himself if he were the girl that he wants to date, or for the customer in the restaurant to know how much he would dislike a scene if he were the waiter instead. This is one of the reasons why talk is not a substitute for moves. Moves can in some way alter the game by incurring manifest costs, risks, or a reduced range of subsequent choice. They have an information content or evidence content of a different character from that of speech. Talk can be cheap when moves are not, except for the talk that takes the form of enforceable threats, promises, commitments, and so forth. And that is to be analyzed under the heading of moves rather than communication anyway. Mutual accommodation ultimately requires, if the outcome is to be efficient, that the division of gains be in accordance with comparative advantage. That is, the things a player concedes should be those that he wants less than the other player, relative to the things he trades for. Each needs, therefore, to communicate his value system with some truth, although each can also gain by deceiving. While one's maneuvers are not unambiguous in their revelation of one's value systems, and may even be deliberately deceptive, they nevertheless have an evidential quality that mere speech has not. The uncertainty that can usually be presumed to exist about each other's value systems also reduces the usefulness of the concept of mathematical symmetry as a normative or predictive principle. Mathematical symmetry cannot be perceived if one has access to only half the relevant magnitudes. To the extent that symmetry is helpful to the players in accommodating their movements to each other's, it would tend to be symmetry of a more qualitative sort, of the kind that depends on visible context rather than underlying values. Chapter 5. Enforcement, Communication, and Strategic Moves. Whenever we speak of deterrence, atomic blackmail, the balance of terror, or an open skies arrangement to reduce the fear of surprise attack, when we characterize American troops in Europe as a tripwire or plate glass window, or propose that a threatened enemy be provided a face-saving exit, when we advert to the impotence of a threat that is so enormous that the threatener would obviously shrink from carrying it out, or observe that taxi drivers are given a wide berth because they are known to be indifferent to dents and scratches, we are evidently deep in game theory. Yet formal game theory has contributed little to the clarification of these ideas. The author suggests that non-zero-sum game theory may have missed its most promising field by being pitched at too abstract a level of analysis. By abstracting from communication and enforcement systems, and by treating perfect symmetry between players as the general case rather than a special one, game theory may have overshot the level at which the most fruitful work could be done, and may have defined away some of the essential ingredients of typical non-zero-sum games. Preoccupied with the solution to the non-zero-sum game, game theory has not done justice to some typical game situations or game models, and to the moves that are peculiar to non-zero-sum games of strategy. What model, for example, epitomizes the controversy over massive retaliation? What conditions are necessary for an efficacious threat? What in game theory corresponds to the proverbial situation to have a bear by the tail? How do we identify the payoff matrix, the communication system, and the enforcement system that it embodies? What are the tactics by which pedestrians intimidate automobile drivers or small countries' large ones? And how do we formulate them in game theoretical terms? What is the information or communication structure or the complex of incentives that makes dogs, idiots, small children, fanatics, and martyrs immune to threats? The precarious strategy of Cold War and nuclear stalemate has often been expressed in game-type analogies. two enemies within reach of each other's poison arrows on opposite sides of a canyon, the poison so slow that either could shoot the other before he died. A shepherd who has chased a wolf into a corner where it has no choice but to fight, the shepherd unwilling to turn his back on the beast. A pursuer armed only with a hand grenade who inadvertently gets too close to his victim and dares not use his weapon. Two neighbors, each controlling dynamite in the other's basement, trying to find mutual security through some arrangement of electric switches and detonators. If we can analyze the structures of these games and develop a working acquaintance with standard models, we may provide insight into real problems by the use of our theory. To illustrate, an instructive model is that of 20 men held up for robbery or ransom by a single man who has a gun and 6 bullets. They can overwhelm him if they are willing to lose 6 of themselves, if they have a means of deciding which 6 to lose. They can defeat him without loss if they can visibly commit themselves to a threat to do so. If they can simultaneously commit themselves to a promise to abstain from capital punishment once they have caught him. He can deter their threat if he can visibly commit himself to shoot in disregard of any subsequent threat they might make, or if he can show that he could not believe their promise. If they cannot deliver their threat, if, say, he understands only a foreign language, they cannot disarm him verbally, nor can they make a threat unless they agree on it themselves. So, if he can threaten to shoot any two who talk together, he can deter agreement. If the 20 cannot find a way to divide the risk, there may be no one to go first to carry out the threat, hence no way to make the threat persuasive. And if he can announce a formula for shooting, such as that those who move first get shot first, he can deter them unless they find a way to move together without a first. If 14 of the 20 can overpower the remaining 6 and force them to advance, they can demonstrate that they could overwhelm the man. If so, the threat succeeds and the gunman surrenders, and even the 6 expendables gain through their own inability to avoid jeopardy. If the 20 could overwhelm the man but have no way of letting him escape, a promise of immunity may be necessary. But if they cannot deny their capacity to identify him and testify against him later, it may be necessary to let him take a hostage. This, in turn, depends on the ability of 19 to enforce their own agreement to protect by silence whoever is currently the hostage, and so on. When we have identified the critical ingredients in several games of this sort, we may be in a better position to understand the basis of power of an unpopular despot, or of a well-organized dominant minority, or the conditions for successful mutiny. This chapter is an attempt to suggest the kinds of typical moves and structural elements that deserve to be explored within the framework of game theory. They include such moves as threat, promise, destruction of communication, delegation of decision, and so forth, and such structural elements as the communication and enforcement provisions. An illustrative move. An example of a standard move is the commitment analyzed at some length in Chapter 3. If the institutional environment makes it possible for a potential buyer to make a single final offer subject to extreme penalty in the event he should amend the offer, to commit himself, there remains but a single well-determined decision for the seller, to sell at the price proposed or to forego the sale. The possibility of commitment converts an indeterminate bargaining situation into a two-move game. One player assumes a commitment, and the other makes a final decision. The game has become determinate. This particular move, analyzed at length in Chapter 3, is mentioned here only as a particularly simple illustration of a typical move. As noted in Chapter 3, the availability and the efficacy of this move depend on the communication structure of the game, and the ability of the player to find a way to commit himself, to enforce the commitment against himself. Furthermore, we have allowed the move structure of the game to be asymmetrical. The winner is the one who can assume the commitment, or, if both can, the one who can do it first. We can consider the special case of a tie, but we have not, by an assumption of symmetry, made ties a foregone conclusion. But although we have made the game determinate in the sense that we have no difficulty in identifying the solution once we have identified which of the two players can first commit himself, it remains a game of strategy. Though the winner is the one who achieves his commitment first, the game is not like a foot race that goes to the fastest. The difference is that the commitment does not automatically win under the rules of the game, either physically or legally. The outcome still depends on the second player, over whom the first player has no direct control. The commitment is a strategic move, a move that induces the other player to choose in one's favor. It constrains the other player's choice by affecting his expectations. The power to commit oneself in this kind of game is equivalent to first move. And if the institutional arrangements provide no means for incurring an irrevocable commitment in a legal or contractual sense, one may accomplish the same thing by an irreversible maneuver that reduces his own freedom of choice. One escapes an undesired invitation by commitment when he arranges a prior engagement. Failing that, he can deliberately catch cold. Luce and Rafa have pointed out that the same tactic can be used by a person against himself when he wants. For example, to go on a diet but does not trust himself. He announces his intention or accepts a wager that he will not break his diet so that later he will not be free to change his mind and to optimize his actions according to his tastes at that time. The same thing is accomplished by maneuver rather than by commitment when one deliberately embarks on a vacation deep in the wilds without cigarettes. Threats. The distinctive character of a threat is that one asserts that he will do, in a contingency, what he would manifestly prefer not to do if the contingency occurred, the contingency being governed by the second party's behavior. Like the ordinary commitment, the threat is a surrender of choice, a renunciation of alternatives that makes one worse off than he need be in the event the tactic fails. The threat and the commitment are both motivated by the possibility that a rational second player can be constrained by his knowledge that the first player has altered his own incentive structure. Like an ordinary commitment, a threat can constrain the other player only insofar as it carries to the other player at least some appearance of obligation. If I threaten to blow us both to bits unless you close the window, you know that I won't unless I have somehow managed to leave myself no choice in the matter. The threat differs from the ordinary commitment, however, in that it makes one's course of action conditional on what the other player does. While the commitment fixes one's course of action, the threat fixes a course of reaction, of response to the other player. The commitment is a means of gaining first move in a game in which first move carries an advantage. The threat is a commitment to a strategy for second move. A threat can therefore be effective only if the game is one in which the first move is up to the other player, or one can force the other player to move first. But if one must, in a mechanical sense, move first or simultaneously, he can still force the legal equivalent of first move on the other by attaching his threat to a demand that the other promise in advance how he will behave. If the game has communication and enforcement structures that make promises feasible and that the party to be threatened cannot destroy in advance, the hold-up man whose rich victim happens to have no money on him at the time can make nothing of his opportunity unless he can extract a hostage while he awaits payment. And even that will not work unless he can himself find a way to assume a convincing commitment to return the hostage in a manner that does not subject himself to identification or capture. The fact that some kind of commitment, or at least appearance of commitment, must lie behind the threat and be successfully communicated to the threatened party, is in contradiction to another notion that often appears in game theory. This is the notion that a threat is desirable or admissible or plausible only if the reaction threatened would cause worse damage to the threatened party than to the party making the threat. This is the view of Luce and Rafa, who characterize threats by the phrase, "This will hurt you more than it hurts me," explicitly making threats depend on interpersonal utility comparisons. In the event that both players attempt to make plausible threats, they say, the result becomes indeterminate, depending on the bargaining personalities of the players. And to predict what will in fact happen without first having a complete psychological and economic analysis of the players seems foolish indeed. But the issue is both simpler and more precise than that. Consider the left-hand matrix in Figure 9 in the supplement, where Column is assumed to have first move. Without threats, Column has an easy win. He chooses strategy uppercase Roman numeral 1, forcing Rho to choose between payoffs of 1 and 0. Rho chooses strategy lowercase Roman numeral 1, providing Column a payoff of 2. But if we allow Rho to make a threat, he declares that he will choose strategy lowercase Roman numeral 2 unless Column chooses uppercase Roman numeral 2. That is, he gives Column a choice of lowercase Roman numeral 2, uppercase Roman numeral 1, or lowercase Roman numeral 1, uppercase Roman numeral 2, by committing himself to that conditional choice. If Column went ahead and chose uppercase Roman numeral 1, of course, Rho would prefer to choose lowercase Roman numeral 1. And they both know it. The tactic succeeds only if Column believes that Rho must choose lowercase Roman numeral 2 in the event of uppercase Roman numeral 1. Either he does believe this, or he does not. If he does not, the threat is nothing at all to him. He goes ahead and makes his best first move, choosing uppercase Roman numeral 1. If he does believe that Rho must follow a strategy of lowercase Roman numeral 1, uppercase Roman numeral 2, or lowercase Roman numeral 2, uppercase Roman numeral 1, Column prefers 1 to 0, and chooses uppercase Roman numeral 2. But this is true of any numbers that we might put in the matrix that reflect the same order of preferences. It is true of the right-hand matrix as well. That one dramatizes the essential character of the threat more than the first one, since the penalty on Rho of an irrational choice by Column is greater in this case. But for rational play and full information, Rho need not worry. Column's preference is clear, and once Rho has given him the pair to choose from, lowercase Roman numeral 2, uppercase Roman numeral 1 versus lowercase Roman numeral 1, uppercase Roman numeral 2. There is no doubt what Column will do. If I threaten to blow my brains all over your new suit unless you give me that last slice of toast, you'll give me the toast or not, depending on whether you know that I've arranged to have to do so, exactly as if I'd only threatened to throw my scrambled eggs at you. The issue here is in whether or not we admit that the game has moves, that is, that it is possible for one player or both players to take actions in the course of the game that irreversibly change the game itself, that in some fashion alter the payoff matrix, the order of choices, or the information structure of the game. If the game by its definition admits no moves of any sort except mutual agreement and refusal to agree, then it may be true that the personalities of the players determine the outcome, in the sense that their expectations in a moveless game converge by a process that is wholly psychic. But if a threat is anything more than an assertion that is intended to appeal to the other player by power of suggestion, we must ask what more it can be, and it must involve some notion of commitment, real or fake, if it is to be anything. Commitment is to be interpreted broadly here. It includes maneuvers that leave one in such a position that the option of non-fulfillment no longer exists, as when one intimidates the other car by driving too fast to stop in time. Maneuvers that shift the final decision beyond recall to another party whose incentive structure would provide an ex post motive for fulfillment. as when the authority to punish is deliberately given to sadists or when one shifts his claims and liabilities to an insurance company, and maneuvers that simply worsen one's own payoff in the contingency of non-fulfillment so that even the horror of a mutually damaging fulfillment becomes more attractive. As when one arranges for himself to appear a public coward if he fails to fulfill, or when he puts a plate glass window in front of his wares or stations women and children on the particular bit of territory that he has threatened somewhat implausibly to defend at great cost. A nice everyday example is given by Irving Goffman, who reminds us that salesmen, especially street stemmers, know that if they take a line that will be discredited unless the reluctant customer buys, the customer may be trapped by considerateness and buy in order to save the face of the salesman and prevent what would ordinarily result in a scene. There are, however, some ways in which this notion of commitment to a threat can be usefully loosened. One is to recognize that firm commitment amounts to the invocation of some wholly potent penalty, such that one would in all circumstances prefer to carry out what he was committed to. It is a penalty of infinite, or at least of superfluous size, that one voluntarily, irreversibly, and visibly attaches to all patterns of action, but the one that he is committed to do. This concept can be loosened by supposing that the penalty is of finite size and not necessarily so large as to be controlling in all cases. In Figure 10 in the supplement, Column will win if he has first move, unless Rho can commit himself to lowercase Roman numeral 1. Commitment obtains first move for Rho. But if commitment means the attachment of a finite penalty to the choice of Rho lowercase Roman numeral 2, and we show this in the matrix by subtracting from each of Rho's payoffs in lowercase Roman numeral 2 some finite amount representing the penalty, then the commitment will be effective only if the penalty is greater than 2. Otherwise, it is clear to Column that Rho's response to uppercase Roman numeral 2 will be lowercase Roman numeral 2, in spite of the commitment. In this case, the commitment is simply a loss that Rho would impose on himself, so he avoids it. Similarly, with a threat. In Figure 11, without threats, the solution is at lowercase Roman numeral 3, uppercase Roman numeral 2, whether the rules call for Rho to choose first, Column first, or both to choose simultaneously. Either player can win if he can move second and confront the other with a threat. Column would threaten uppercase Roman numeral 1 against lowercase Roman numeral 3. Rho would threaten lowercase Roman numeral 1 against uppercase Roman numeral 2. But if the threat is secured by a penalty, the lower limit to any persuasive penalty that Column could invoke would be 4. Any smaller penalty leaves him preferring uppercase Roman numeral 2 to uppercase Roman numeral 1 when Rho chooses lowercase Roman numeral 3. The lower limit to a persuasive penalty on Rho's noncompliance would be 3. If, then, the situation is one in which penalties come in a single size, a size less than 3 goes unused, and the outcome is at lowercase Roman numeral 3, uppercase Roman numeral 2. A size greater than 4 is adequate for either player, and the winner is the one who can avail himself of the threat first. A size between 3 and 4 is of use only to Rho, who wins. In this latter case, the player who would be hurt the more by his own unsuccessful threat is the one who cannot threaten. But only through the paradox that he is incapable of calling a sufficiently terrible penalty on his own head. Note that the hurt more comparison in this case refers not to whether Rho or Column would be hurt more by what Rho threatens, but to whether Rho would be hurt more by having to fulfill his own threat than Column would be hurt if, instead, Column had made his threat. Actually, in the particular payoff matrix shown, Rho's successful threat is one that would hurt him more in the fulfillment than it would hurt Column, while Colum's potential unsuccessful threat would hurt him less to fulfill than it would hurt Roe. Another loosening of the threat concept is to alter our assumption of rationality. Suppose there is some probability PR for player R, and some probability PC for player C, that he will make a mistake or an irrational move, or that he will act in an unanticipated way because the other player is mistaken about the first player's payoffs. This yields us a game in which the possible gains and losses in committing oneself to a threat must take into account the possibility that a fully committed threat will not be heeded. If, then, the potential loss that will ensue from having to carry out the threat is greater for one player than for another, there could be symmetrical circumstances, the P's being equal and the threat penalties equal for the two players, in which one player may find it advantageous to make the threat and the other player not, considering the possibility of error. A somewhat similar calculation may be involved if both players have opportunities for threats and there is danger of simultaneous commitment through the failure of one to observe the other's commitment and to stop in time to save both. This modification in the threat concept, in the rationality postulate that underlies it, goes somewhat in the direction of the hurt more criterion. On the whole, though, game theory adds more insight into the strategy of bargaining by emphasizing the striking truth that the threat does not depend on the threateners having less to suffer than the threatened party if the threat had to be carried out, rather than by exaggerating the possible truth contained in the intuitive first impression. Threats of war, of price war, of damage suit, threats to make a scene, most of the threats of organized society to prosecute crimes and misdemeanors, and the concepts of extortion and deterrence generally cannot be understood except by denying the utility comparison criterion. It is indeed the asymmetries in the threat situation as between the two players that make threats a rich subject for study. But the relevant asymmetries include those in the communication system, in the enforceability of threats and of promises, in the speed of commitment, in the rationality of expected responses, and finally, in some cases, in the relative damage criterion. Promises. Enforceable promises cannot be taken for granted. Agreements must be in enforceable terms and involve enforceable types of behavior. Enforcement depends on at least two things: some authority somewhere to punish or coerce, and an ability to discern whether punishment or coercion is called for. The post-war discussions of disarmament proposals and inspection schemes indicate how difficult it may be. Even if both sides should desperately desire to reach an enforceable agreement or find a persuasive means of enforcement, the problem is compounded when neither party trusts the other, and each recognizes that neither trusts the other, and that neither can therefore anticipate the other's compliance. Many of the technical problems of arms inspection would disappear if there were some earthly means of making enforceable promises, or if the nations of the world all rendered unquestioned allegiance to some unearthly authority. But since noncompliance may be undetectable, promises of compliance could not be enforced, even if punishment could be guaranteed. The problem is doubled by the fact that punishment cannot be guaranteed, except such punishment as can unilaterally be meted out by the other party in its act of denouncing the original agreement. Furthermore, some seemingly desirable agreements must be left out for being undefinable operationally. Agreements not to discriminate against each other will work only if defined in objective terms capable of objective supervision. Promises are generally thought of as bilateral, contractual commitments, given against a quid pro quo that is often a promise in return. But there is incentive for a unilateral promise when it provides inducement to the other player to make a choice in the mutual interest. In the left-hand matrix of Figure 12 in the supplement, if choices are to be simultaneous, only a pair of promises can be effective. In the right-hand matrix, Roe's promise brings its own reward. column can safely choose uppercase Roman numeral 2, yielding superior outcomes for both players. If in the left-hand matrix moves are in turn, the player who chooses second must have the power to promise. If the players are themselves to agree on the order of moves and only one of the two can issue promises, they can agree that the other one move first. These promises, in contrast to those for the right-hand matrix, must be conditional on the second player's performance. A unilateral, unconditional promise does the trick on the right-hand side, but not on the left with moves in turn. The witness to a crime has a motive for unilateral promise if the criminal would kill to keep him from squealing. A nation known to be on the threshold of an absolutely potent surprise attack weapon may have reason to forswear it unilaterally, if there is any possible way to do so, in order to forestall a desperate last-minute attempt by an enemy to strike first while he still has a chance. The exact definition of a promise, for example in distinction to a threat, is not obvious. It might seem that a promise is a commitment, conditional or unconditional, that the second party welcomes, one that is mutually advantageous, as in both the games shown in Figure 12. But Figure 13 shows a situation in which Rome must couple a threat and a promise. He threatens lowercase Roman numeral 2 against uppercase Roman numeral 1, and promises lowercase Roman numeral 1 in the event of uppercase Roman numeral 2. The promise ensures column a payoff of 4 rather than 0, once he has made a choice of uppercase Roman numeral 2, and in that sense it is favorable to him. It does so at a cost of 1 unit to Rho. But if Rho could not make the promise, column would win 5. He would because the threat would be ineffectual without the promise, and the threat would not be incurred. A threat of lowercase Roman numeral 2 against uppercase Roman numeral 1 by itself is no good. It cannot force column to choose uppercase Roman numeral 2, since a choice of uppercase Roman numeral 2 leaves him with an outcome at lowercase Roman numeral 2, uppercase Roman numeral 2, 0 instead of 1. Rho's threat can work only if the promise goes with it. The net effect of the promise is to make the threat work, yielding column 4 instead of 5, gaining 5 rather than 2 for Rho. One cannot force spies, conspirators, or carriers of social diseases to reveal themselves solely by the threat of a relentless pursuit that spares no cost. One must also promise immunity to those that come forward. A better definition, perhaps, would make the promise a commitment that is controlled by the second party, that is, a commitment that the second party can enforce or release as he chooses. But timing is important here. The promise just discussed will work after the threat is fully committed. But if the victim of the promise, column, can renounce the promise in advance, so that Rho knows that column expects 0 if he chooses uppercase Roman numeral 2, the threat itself is deterred. And if the threat and promise are contrived in such a way as to be legally inseparable, or if they are accomplished by some irreversible maneuver, the definition becomes obscured. In fact, the definition breaks down whenever the equivalent of a promise is obtained by some irrevocable act rather than by a legal commitment. Actually, whenever the alternative choices are more than 2, threat and promise are likely to be mixed in any reaction pattern that one presents to the other. So it is probably best to consider the threat and the promise to be names for different aspects of the same tactic of selective and conditional self-commitment, which in certain simple instances can be identified in terms of the second party's interest. Enforcement schemes. Agreements are unenforceable if no outside authority exists to enforce them, or if noncompliance would be inherently undetectable. The problem arises then of finding forms of agreement or terms to agree on that provide no incentive to cheat or that make noncompliance automatically visible, or that incur the penalties on which the possibility of enforcement rests. While the possibility of trust between two partners need not be ruled out, it should also not be taken for granted. And even trust itself can usefully be studied in game-theoretic terms. Trust is often achieved simply by the continuity of the relation between parties and the recognition by each that what he might gain by cheating in a given instance is outweighed by the value of the tradition of trust that makes possible a long sequence of future agreement. By the same token, trust may be achieved for a single discontinuous instance if it can be divided into a succession of increments. There are, however, particular game situations that lend themselves to enforceable agreement. One is an agreement that depends on some kind of coordination or complementarity. If two people have disagreed on where to meet for dinner, if two criminal accomplices have disagreed on what joint alibi to give, or if members of a business firm or football team have disputed about what prices they will quote or what tactic they will follow, they nevertheless have an overriding interest in the ultimate consistency of their actions. Once agreement is formally reached, it constitutes the only possible focal point for the necessary subsequent tacit collaboration. No one has a unilateral preference now to do anything but what he is expected to do. In the absence of any other means of enforcement, then, parties might be well advised to try to find agreements that enjoy this property of interdependent expectations, even to the extent of importing into their agreement certain elements whose sole purpose is to create severe jeopardy for non-coordination. Tearing the treasure map in half or letting one partner carry the gun and the other the ammunition is a familiar example. The institution of hostages is an ancient technique that deserves to be studied by game theory, as does the practice of drinking wine from the same glass or of holding gang meetings in places so public that neither side could escape if it subjected the other to a massacre. The reported use of only drug addicts as agents or employees in a narcotics ring is a fairly straightforward example of a unilateral hostage. Perhaps a sufficient interchange of populations between nations that hate each other, or an agreement to move the governing agencies of both countries to a single island where they would occupy alternate blocks of the city, could be resorted to if both sides became sufficiently desperate to avoid mutual destruction. A principal drawback to the exchange of hostages on the assumption of rational behavior is the inherent unknowability of each other's value system adverted to earlier. The king who sends his daughter as a hostage to his enemy's court may be incapable of assuaging his enemy's fears that he really dislikes the girl. We could probably guarantee the Russians against an American surprise attack by having the equivalent of junior year abroad at the kindergarten level. If every American 5-year-old went to kindergarten in Russia, in American establishments constructed for the purpose, designed solely for hostage purposes and not for cultural interchange, and if each year's incoming group arrived before the graduating class left, there would not seem to be the slightest chance that America would ever initiate atomic destruction in Russia. We cannot be quite sure that the Russians would be quite sure of this. Nor can we be quite sure that a reciprocal program would be as much of a deterrent to the Russian government. Unfortunately, even if the Russian government were bound by the fear of harming Russian children, it seems nearly impossible for it to persuade us so. Still, in many surprise attack situations, a unilateral promise is better than none. And the idea of hostages may be worth considering, even when symmetrical exchanges do not seem available. Actually, the hostage idea is logically identical with the notion that a disarmament agreement between the major powers might be more efficacious, and probably more subject to technical control, if it related to defensive weapons and structures. To eschew defense is, in effect, to make hostages of your entire population without bothering to put them physically into the other's possession. Thus, we can put our children at the mercy of the Russians and receive similar power over Russian children not only by physically trading them, with enormous discomfort and breach of constitutional rights, but also by simply agreeing to leave them so unprotected that the other can do them as much damage where they are as if he had them in his grasp. Thus, the balance of terror that is so often adverted to is, if in fact it exists and is stable, equivalent to a total exchange of all conceivable hostages. The analogy requires that the balance be stable, that is, that neither side be able by surprise attack to destroy the other's power to strike back.